طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. Thank you for tuning in, whether you're listening on the radio, streaming on your computer, or checking us out on the archive. We appreciate your joining us. This Week in Palestine features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian point of view, which is so lacking in the mainstream media, but so needed to counter the Israeli narrative that is based on factual inaccuracies, myths, and distortions. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. Despina Moutsouris is our producer, and I am your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with a Wanda Weiss report out of Israel of the continuing provocations by the Jewish settler community at the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the so-called Temple Mount in the heart of the Old City in Jerusalem. Sacred to Muslims, but desired by Jews because the mosque sits upon the ruins of the Second Temple at the Western Wall, Jewish settlers have had as their long-desired goal what they consider the liberation of the Temple Mount, now in the hands of Muslims. And so last week, settlers and Israeli intelligence members again barged into the yards of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The violations come as the Yeshivat Makor Chaim, rightist Orthodox school, called a wide break into the mosque with students and rabbis. Consequently, Israeli forces prevented female worshippers and guards from entering the mosque and forcefully displaced them from the mosque surroundings and gates to let the settlers enter at ease. Women for the Temple organization has also called on an educational day to teach about the proclaimed Temple Mount, as the Temple Coalition called on more settlers to barge into the mosque for 4 days this month. The situation in Jerusalem has been intense and nervous for the past week after settler attacks and closures of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Dozens of Palestinians were reportedly injured when Israeli and Palestinian Authority forces suppressed protests across the West Bank amid continuing entry restrictions to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem. The clashes are still continuing in cities all over the West Bank. Moving on. The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development issued a report September 1st on the status of its assistance to the Palestinian people in the occupied territories of Gaza and the West Bank. The report paints a bleak picture, but it is an objective assessment of the latest conditions in Gaza. The population of Gaza is 1.8 million people, approximately the combined total of the cities of San Francisco and San Jose, California. Through 8 years of military blockade and three successive wars in 2008, 2012, and 2014, Israel has destroyed and degraded the Gazan infrastructure and economy. Unemployment in the Gaza Strip is at 44%. 6 in 10 households suffer from food insecurity. Since 2007, exports from Gaza are banned and imports and transfers of cash are severely limited. Flow of all but the most basic humanitarian goods has been suspended. Per capita gross domestic product in Gaza is 74% of what it was prior to the Oslo Accords. The report indicates a real GDP per capita in constant 2004 dollars of $1,000, about $2.70 a day. Among young women, the employment rate is 80%. The ramifications of persistently high unemployment will be devastating in the long term, says the report, as training and education among the long-term unemployed became obsolete. The latest military operation in 2014 has destroyed virtually all of what was left of the middle class in Gaza, says the report, relegating almost all of the population into destitution and dependence on international and humanitarian aid. During the military operation in the summer of 2014, more than 500,000 Gazans were displaced, and more than 100,000 remain so as of mid-2015. A partial list of damage listed in the report includes 18,000 housing units destroyed or badly damaged, 26 schools destroyed and 226 damaged, 17 hospitals and 56 primary health centers damaged. Gaza's sole power plant severely affected by damage, lack of fuel, and extensive damage to power lines. 20-30% of the water and sewerage network damaged. Water desalination plant in Deir al-Balah damaged. 220 agricultural wells destroyed or badly damaged. 40,000 agricultural workers affected by damage to land and destruction of livestock. 247 factories and 300 commercial establishments destroyed or badly damaged. The combined damage from the past three wars totals more than 300% of Gaza's potential GDP in full employment. Gaza faces a severe water crisis. It relies almost completely on a coastal aquifer as the source of its drinking water, but 95% of this water is not potable without treatment. Years of over-extraction have left the aquifer on the verge of collapse, threatening its long-term viability. Groundwater levels have declined and seawater has rushed in, increasing salinity and making the water not safe for drinking according to WHO standards. The aquifer may become unusable as early as 2016. Destruction of sewage facilities has made matters worse. About 33 million cubic meters of untreated, inadequately treated sewage are dumped into the Mediterranean every year. The electricity demand of the strip cannot be met. Only a fraction of needed electricity is available. The development of gas fields discovered within Gaza's waters could help a lot, but Israel's occupation does not permit these fields to be developed. As of now, Gaza lacks the resources and support to reconstruct the damage. It lacks the ability to develop its economy. The situation is bleak. In this timely piece, also from Mondo Weiss, while the Pope makes his first visit to the U.S., where he is expected to meet with school children, he has been called upon by members of the oldest churches at the roots of Christianity in the Middle East to intervene to end the financial crisis of nearly 50 schools serving the Palestinian community inside Israel. These schools provide education to over 33,000 Palestinian students in Israel, Christians, Muslims, and Druze, and have been on strike since September 1st in protest of the Israeli government's decision to further cut governmental funding of elementary church-run schools in Israel. Unlike the United States, where there is separation between church and state, Israel has no such separation, and religious schools are funded by taxpayer money. Church-run schools in Israel, some of which were founded centuries ago and served children of all faiths who lived inside historic Palestine, have been under gradual governmental cuts that have caused a serious financial crisis. Their mission and ability to provide high-quality education to the indigenous national minority within Israel is threatened. These government actions are discriminatory because similarly situated Jewish religious schools receive full funding even when they are not following the Israeli Ministry of Education's requirements to teach core subjects such as math and science. There are 47 church-run schools that for many decades have served the Palestinian community that survived the war and ethnic cleansing in 1948 and now live within Israel. During the 1948 war, some schools had a humanitarian role, protecting Palestinian orphan children and later helping the devastated community rebuild itself during Israel's military rule that lasted until 1966. Each church-run school in Israel is affiliated with a different Christian denomination, like Baptist School and the Latin School in Nazareth. However, they are all recognized by the Israeli educational system as recognized but unofficial schools. This group includes church-run schools as well as religious Jewish Orthodox schools. These schools receive governmental funding per number of children attending the school, which is usually supplemented by parents' fees towards their children's education. Dr. Riyad Kamel, who currently serves as the principal of Mar Joseph School in Nazareth, maintains that school-run schools have been suffering from gradual desiccation for years. This gradual reduction of governmental funding to church-run schools over the last few years has resulted in the current situation of unequal distribution of educational funding in the country. Church-run schools receive funding to cover only 29% of their total operating costs in comparison to similar-sized Jewish, Haredi, and religious schools, which have 100% of their costs covered by the government. Since school tuition fees are regulated by the Israeli government, religiously run schools have not been able to make up for the lack of government funding by raising their fees to parents. This has made it impossible for many schools to obtain the money required to operate. Since Israel's establishment, church-run schools have been carrying the burden of providing high-quality education to the Palestinian community. They have become the primary available alternative to Arab public school system, which not only has been historically denied equal funding, but has been used by successive Israeli governments as a tool to monitor and control rather than to educate the Palestinian community. Church-run schools also play a vital role in employing Palestinian intellectuals and academics who face discrimination in getting access to the Israeli academia and business sectors, especially in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Their relative autonomy provided some protection against government interference in regard to teacher appointments, and the autonomy helped ensure that criticism and activism against government discrimination and dispossession of the Palestinian people since 1948 were not monitored or silenced. As a result, this relatively independent school system has become a major source of power to resist and push back against structural racism and continued policies of discrimination. Many Arab leaders in Israel rightly refer to the church-run schools as national forts because they provide high-quality education and vital opportunities to the marginalized and oppressed Palestinian community. These institutions strive to preserve the identity and culture of the Arab population and promote unity among all members of the Palestinian community. The crisis of church-run schools should be understood in the context of ongoing government attempts to isolate and separate its Palestinian Christian citizens from the larger Palestinian community as evidenced by the recent concerted efforts to enlist Palestinian Christians in the Israeli army. These acts are part of a long policy of divide and conquer, which aims to disempower the Palestinian community and force it to submit to second-class citizenship. These Palestinians in Nazareth believe that the reason for this latest governmental cut is simply retaliation for the Pope's signing a treaty recognizing the state of Palestine in June 2015. Yet the cuts have been building for years, so it cannot be solely attributed to the Pope's stance on Palestine. Pope Francis's heartening humility and devotion to social justice gives faith that he will continue to pressure the Israeli government to end this outrageous crisis that is hurting thousands of children and their families. He must also back the call to expand the strike to include the closure of churches, a main source of tourism in Israel, and deprive the Israeli government of a major source of tourism revenue as long as Palestinian children are denied their basic civil and human rights. For our feature presentation this week, we continue our examination of the Israeli lobby and its effect on Congress. A few weeks ago, we heard from former West Virginia Congressman Nick Rehal, and this week we hear from one of the original critical voices within the U.S. Congress. Former Republican Representative Paul Finley of Ohio began his criticism in the late 70s. The lobby eventually successfully dispensed of Representative Finley by pushing a gerrymandering scheme that successfully brought about his defeat at the polls. But it took a while. Now 94 years old, Paul Finley speaks with difficulty, but does deliver what he claims to be his last speech at the April 2015 conference in Washington, D.C. that explored the dimensions of the reach of the Israeli lobby. The presentation begins with his introduction to the conference.
Many Americans first learned about the Israel lobby when they read our next speaker's groundbreaking book, They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby, first published in 1985. It has subsequently been translated into Arabic, German, Urdu, Malaysian, and Indonesian, so one can truthfully say that the word has spread far and wide. Paul Finley served the 20th District of Congress as its Republican representative from 1961 to 1983. He became involved in Middle East issues after helping a constituent who had been imprisoned in South Yemen. As Congressman Finley heard complaints about U.S. bias in the region and began to learn the reason behind that bias, he became a target of the Israel lobby in this country. Paul Finley lost his bid for re-election in 1982 after his congressional district was redrawn, another tactic used to eliminate critics of Israel. Since then, he has continued to speak out, writing numerous books, speaking to audiences around the world, and co-founding the Council for the National Interest. It is indeed an honor to introduce Congressman Paul Finley.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to have this opportunity, a special treat to hear the others on the panel. And I'd like to recommend, first of all, that Nick, you reconsider and run for election again, and I'll either support you or oppose you, whichever will help you the more. I congratulate the people who founded the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs and those who survive and have initiated what I hope will become an annual conference like this. I'm delighted to be here. I appreciate the cooperation of my son, Craig. I couldn't travel without him, so he took off 3 days to enable us, me, to be here. And I appreciate the contribution to public understanding of the Arab world that I believe was the main motivation of Dick Curtis and Andy Kilgore in starting the American Educational Trust and the magazine, the bi-monthly, that is sponsoring this event. They have served their country well, and I think the initiative represented here in this room is a good one that I hope will be repeated in the years to come. Of recent months, the U.S. government has displayed on enormous international television for all to see the shameful subservience to Israel and its lobby. That's what brings me here tonight. Turn your thoughts back to last October. The thundering assault on Gaza, that tiny open-air prison where people have to struggle just to live from one day to the other. The toll of death, 2,200. The toll of injured, 11,000 more. Shattered schools, hospitals, almost everything that made up the struggling economy of Gaza was shattered in just a few hours. World leaders thundered their opposition, all except one leader, and that was Mr. Obama. A reporter finally accosted him and said, "What do you say about the Gaza war?" I was watching television that night, and I was struck by the grim countenance of President Obama. All he said was, "The Israelis have the right of self-defense, period, nothing else." It seemed to me that that was all he was permitted to say by higher authority. And no reporter pressed him for elaboration. To me, that said that the reporters of the major media in this country are just as overwhelmed and paralyzed by the Israel lobby as our government seems to be most of the time. A month ago, as Nick said, an amazing event took place on Capitol Hill. And I know that Nick Rahal feels, as I do, and Jim Moran feels the same way, that there is something sacred in the House of Representatives chamber. It's one of the cherished heirlooms of our republic. The symbol, if there is one single outstanding preeminent symbol of liberty and free speech, it's the House chamber. And it was a sad moment for me when I realized that the lobby for Israel has sufficient power to gain control of the House chamber and to put on what is nothing more than a campaign speech for the benefit of Netanyahu 10 days before his bid for a fourth term. Our government cooperated in that desecration of that heirloom of our great republic, the House Chamber. Another demonstration. And as a background for this choreographed performance, 90% of the Senate and 90% of the House showed up to take part as a part of the cheering section. It was a rude and crude moment for our country. The massive worldwide television audience that day received shocking evidence of Apex, towering political clout over our government. I can't see it any other way. It was done in precise defiance of the U.S. president, done in defiance of the presidency itself. It makes me wonder what overcame the Republicans in the House of Representatives to bypass tradition and decorum. But it's a pity also that our president had not sent a word notifying Netanyahu that he would not be welcome in America until after Election Day. It didn't happen. You know, do any of you remember the Canadian episode that involved Charles de Gaulle, the president of France, and Quebec, the French province in Canada? It was all stirred up about the possibility of secession of Quebec. And Charles de Gaulle, a man I admire intensely, made a big mistake. He decided to rally the troops, and he was on a boat going up the St. Lawrence River to Quebec to take part in the celebration. Lester Pearson, the Prime Minister of Canada, said, Mr. Charles de Gaulle, turn back. This is not the right time for the President of France to make an appearance. What a model that was, because because Charles de Gaulle immediately turned around. He didn't get on Quebec soil. He got on the launch, turned around, went back, as he should, and as Lester Pearson directed him to do. Quite a difference in the reaction of the president or the prime minister of Canada and the president of the United States. And if he had ordered, if Obama had ordered Netanyahu not to come until after Election Day, I'm sure that the masses of the American people would shout with joy at his nerve. But it didn't happen. AIPAC even then showed its immense power over our government. That's the tip of the iceberg, the show on Capitol Hill, and the silence of President Obama about the desecration of Gaza. And yet, I saw on television just the other day, Netanyahu said, I respect the President of the United States. I respect the presidency of America. What a lie. What a contemptible lie to come from the head of a government. Now I'd like to turn to Israel's biggest massacre. Excuse me. I have very little eyesight. I am using water pills, and not many of you young people know, knows what that's all about. But I've departed twice, but I'm determined to stick this out. The tips of the iceberg give no hint of the suffocating influence of the Lobby for Israel across America. It's as if a suffocating blanket, had been spread across the entire nation. It's not just what happens in Washington, what happens on Capitol Hill, what happens in other places. I doubt if many people realize the extent of the paralyzing influence that reaches across the nation, not just in big cities, but in small towns and hamlets. There are people that are willing to spend time to guard the gates, so to speak, for Israel every day. They're on the alert for anyone who might say something or do something that would show disapproval of Israel. These agents exist by the hundreds and hundreds throughout the country. And of course, they are concentrated heavily as well in Washington. I'll give you just one example. Harold Saunders, a great diplomat that I worked with quite closely over the years, told me that if he wanted to get a letter to the Secretary of State, his boss, that dealt with misbehavior by Israel, he said, I have to sit down, type the letter myself, go to the Secretary's office and hand it to him personally. If I would put the letter in the usual desk-to-desk transition up to the top of the State Department building, it would emerge emasculated so thoroughly that the intention would never appear. Imagine that. Couldn't depend on a letter arriving as intended to the Secretary of State. He was very upset when he told me that. There are hundreds of people in our government who feel that they have a duty to guard Israel against any mischief or any harm. They aren't paid. They aren't paid by the AIPAC. They're paid by the taxpayers. But they feel this total obligation to defend Israel. And I, in a sense, admire people like that, but it has resulted in the destruction of free speech about Israel and the U.S. throughout the nation. This is a rare occasion here tonight. People openly discussing the misbehavior of the State of Israel, criticizing the Lobby for the State of Israel. It's a remarkable occasion, because you would search the city over and you won't find another like this. And it's a great credit to the the leadership of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs that this meeting is being held. Now, they act out of fear. They fear that Israel will be hurt. Others act out of fear for a different reason. They fear that they might be accused, even by indirection, of being anti-Semitic. The charge of anti-Semitism is still the most powerful instrument of intimidation that Israel's lobby has. And it exists among these people that feel duty-bound to protect Israel every step of the way. And if you think back about your home country, your home's village in the past, you can be sure that someone in every village, every city, every hamlet is there to protect the interest of the state of Israel. And it's a very scary scene, one that is not receiving any attention in our government at all. It's not fear of bodily harm that causes people to watch what they say about Israel. It's the fear that they might be considered a border case, at least, of anti-Semitism. And most of the people in this country still believe that that's the worst stain any person could have on his or her reputation, anti-Semitism. By the way, you may have noticed I made a brief departure several times. The pain of my existence is water pills. Now, if you're troubled about the length of lectures in the future, you might restrict speakers to people who are on water pills. The lobby is something more than just a suffocating blanket across the country. It's something more than a lobby that has enough moxie, enough hubris to get things done on Capitol Hill and in the White House. It is also a large, effective lobby, as Nick mentioned. And it is one of a small group of giant Washington-based lobbies that have had the effect of destroying true representative government in this country. They are the power that makes big decisions on public policy, not the people that are elected from the home districts and the states to serve in Congress. It's not that group that holds the real power. It's a group of unelected people who manage big lobbies that have big money to spend in order to control what's done as public policy. And as Nick has pointed out, that's a great difficulty to overcome, because the Supreme Court has declared that the right of free speech extends even to corporations. And these corporations, like others in these lobbies, need not disclose who they are or what they're spending their billions on. I conclude that the only real hope is a constitutional amendment that will authorize the Congress to limit campaign spending. And the key provision of the amendment that I would recommend is one that declares that no contributor can send money into a constituency unless that contributor is himself or herself a domiciled resident of that constituency and has and is able to swear that he or she has been domiciled in that very constituency for 2 years. Otherwise, no qualification. I don't know of anything short of a constitutional amendment that can correct the terrible menace of lobbies based here in this city. They are running the country today, and they're going to run it until we find a way legally to restore true representative government in our society. Thank you very much. I thank you so much for that response. I came here tonight hoping that I had one good speech left. I'll soon be 94, and I guess I've come pretty close to that point. Let me close by quoting my hero, another Illinois man who became president. He said, "Fellow citizens, you cannot escape history. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down to the very latest generation. No insignificance or significance can spare a one of us. We can nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth." Thank you very much.
That was former congressional representative from Ohio, Paul Findlay, speaking at the conference on the Israeli lobby, which took place last April at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Can you imagine a Republican today calling out Israel the way Paul Findlay did some 30 years ago? We desperately need that kind of courage on both sides of the aisle in the U.S. Congress today. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or listen to this week's program anytime via the archive found in the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday Morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts at any time, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.